Marty Moscowen, welcome to Radio Times. We hope to be hooked up with Zach Hampel in just a moment or two. He's at the NPR Bureau in New York, and we just need to make contact with him. We invited him actually to be a guest on Radio Times because he does a very unusual thing. In fact, Zach Hampel has an obsession with baseballs, has made quite a name for himself as a ball hawk. He has a huge collection of balls that he's caught or snagged off the field at games and batting practice. He's actually multilingual when it comes to asking players to toss him a ball. He's scoped out stadiums to map out the best place to catch a fly ball. Hampel is part of a small and passionate group of baseball fans who care more about the ball than the game, the stats, or the team. And he's written a new book called The Baseball: Stunts, Scandals, and Secrets Beneath the Stitches. He takes a baseball apart literally to reveal its history and evolution. He also has some tips for would-be ball hawks. And Zach Hampel does join us from NPR's New York Bureau, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So where do we stand as of today in terms of how many balls you've caught this season?
This season, 699.
Wow.
In 84 games. So you do the math, it's about 8.3 balls a game.
And is that a pretty good statistic for you?
That's actually a little below average for what it's been the last couple of years. And that number does include balls from batting practice, just to be up front here. I don't catch 8 home runs or 8 foul balls during the actual game itself.
One could only hope, right?
Yeah, seriously.
So where, and you have what, 5,000 and some balls at this point, yes?
Yeah, 5,300 plus.
And where do you store them or stack these balls?
I've given a lot of baseballs away to kids over the years, so I don't own all the baseballs that I've caught. If I catch a ball and give it away, I still count it for my grand total. But I still have an awful lot of them. Many of them are at my mom's place in my old childhood bedroom, and she wants them out.
She does.
She does. They're in big recycling barrels, these big plastic bins that are 32 gallons each with lids that snap shut. They hold 400 balls apiece, so I have 8 of those full, plus some filing drawers, duffel bags, plastic shopping bags. Yeah, it's kind of getting out of hand.
Well, and I can understand how your mother might be feeling. Now, do you go to your room and look at these balls and kind of remember the moment when you snagged a ball somewhere?
Well, it's hard to tell a lot of them apart. For the first 2,000 balls that I snagged, I just would toss them in the drawers, toss them in the barrels, and not really think much more about them. Some of them would have really distinct markings that I could distinguish later. But after that, I started marking the balls so I'd be able to remember them. So I just simply write the number on the ball that it is within my collection. So like the next ball that I catch, I'll be at Citi Field today for the Mets-Padres game. The next one will be number 5,362. So I'll just write that little 4-digit number on the ball, and then keep a separate list on my computer with the corresponding details.
When I was writing up the introduction to the show, and I ended up saying Zach Hampel has an obsession with baseballs, I began with Zach Hampel loves baseballs, but I changed it to obsession. Should I change it back to love?
You could change it to sickness if you want. Yeah, it's all of the above. I don't know. I think my hobby has taken on different forms over the years. There was a time back in 1996, after I snagged my 1,000th ball and I was getting ready to go off to college, I thought I was done with it. And I picked a school in North Carolina, Guilford College in Greensboro, that was, I think, 5 hours from the closest major league city, Atlanta, just because I wanted to get away from it. There were girls and there was college life to be lived, and I really didn't think that I was going to continue doing this much longer. But then I ended up writing a book about it after my freshman year, How to Snag Major League Baseballs, and that just kind of rejuvenated my passion for it and kind of got a lot of attention, I think maybe even more than it should have. It's kind of a media-friendly hobby, and that really got me back into it.
So a career was born out of an obsession, I guess?
Yeah, you could definitely say that.
Now, you did play ball, right? You played baseball in high school and a little bit in college as well. Did I read that right?
Yeah, I played baseball ever since I could stand on 2 feet. And my dream would have been, and it still is really, to be out there on the field with those guys. And sometimes I feel like I'm good enough. But, this is a good second place, I guess, to be in the stands catching baseballs, feeling like I'm somewhat of a participant, even though I'm a little bit removed from the game, and writing about it and going to games with people and really making my living through baseball. So I can't really complain.
And how many fly balls have you caught during a baseball game? Do you know?
Well, I've gotten 155 baseballs directly off the bat during games. So that breaks down to, let me see. I'm geeky, but not geeky enough to have all of my stats totally memorized. But this is a big one. So let me see. 138 foul balls.
Okay.
16 home runs and one ground rule double.
And you have scoped out a lot of these stadiums to try to find the right place to be when a ball is actually hit by a batter, yes?
Yeah, I think one thing about catching baseballs at games that a lot of people don't realize is that the stadium itself, sort of the architectural layout, determines an awful lot about how easy it is to catch baseballs. Then you have to look at the size of the crowd, and then you have to look at security and how they run the place and how strict they are. You know, when I go to Citi Field, if I have a seat behind the dugout and I want to move to a worse seat in the outfield to try to catch a home run, they actually won't let me do that.
Oh,
they're
wow.
really strict there. Same with Yankee Stadium. You have to go to your ticketed section, even if you're trying to move to a worse section. At most stadiums, you know, you can move around a little bit, just in the same way that people jaywalk, and you're not really supposed to, but everybody does it, and you're not really going to get in trouble. The same rules kind of apply at Major League stadiums. Yeah, you're supposed to go to your seat, but I think it's just kind of a tradition that you kind of move around a little bit. You move down a few rows, or you know, if seats free up a bit.
And how does Philadelphia stack up?
I like the layout of the stadium quite a bit. There's a lot of outfield seating. The biggest problem with Philadelphia, which of course is not a problem for most people, most normal baseball fans, is that the team is too damn good. So they sell out every game. And they
no
pack
empty
in.
Seats there's, there, right?
Exactly. There's 45,000 fans per game. And that doesn't really make it easy to move around, move to an empty seat. So you have these huge outfield sections that extend all the way from the foul poles pretty much out to left and right center field. So most home runs that are hit are catchable, at least in terms of landing in seating areas, but it's so crowded. And then another problem is that there's no cross aisle or standing room section within the seats, really. I mean, you can stand behind the bullpens in deep right center field, but, you know, Superman on steroids probably won't hit a ball there. So it's tough to run back and forth, left and right, and that's really the key to catching baseballs, is to have some lateral range. Because the odds of a ball coming right to you are very slim. And even if it does, if you're packed in the middle of a long row of fans, who's to say that, you know, some 7-foot guy standing in front of you won't jump up and catch it? You know, so you have to be able to get up and move. So sit on the end of a row if you can. And again, if you're at a stadium that's not packed and you have seat 5, well, maybe seats 1 through 4 are empty and you shuffle over, or maybe the row in front of you has an end seat, and you're not going to get yelled at if you move a couple seats here and there. And better yet, you know, you want to position yourself on an aisle or in a totally empty row or in a standing room only section, like Camden Yards in Baltimore, for example, has a huge standing room only section down the right field line. It's called the flag court. And anybody can hang out there at any time all day, no matter if you have the worst seat in the stadium, you can go and hang out there, and there's a lot of room to run around. So, you know, it's very easy for me to catch home runs during games in Baltimore. I mean, the players still have to hit them, of course, and it's very hard in Philadelphia, and it's really just a matter of the ballpark.
Well, and I would think, obviously, you see players running around catching a ball, that it might be easier to catch a ball on the field than it would be in a stand.
It definitely is, and I think that's another thing that most people don't realize. If you watch a major league outfielder, I mean, it's easy to keep your eye on the ball when it goes up in the air, but just as an experiment, next time you're at a game, and again, it's hard to do this on TV because the cameras only show you what they want to show you, watch the outfielder, not the ball, as a high fly ball is floating down towards him, or any fly ball, you'll see that they don't pick out the exact spot. They drift with the ball right up until the last second. And in a lot of cases, if you watch the outfielder from the moment the ball's hit, you'll see that they sometimes move in the wrong direction. They'll take a quick step back, thinking that it's going to go over their head because the batter takes a ferocious swing, only to then have to run in and make a running catch, you know, or vice versa. And when you're in the seats and you have other fans, you have chairs, you have railings, all kinds of obstacles, you don't have the luxury of just drifting with the ball. So it's really tough, and you kind of have to, either be very lucky or be very skilled at judging a ball and picking out the exact spot where it's going to land.
You're what is called a ball hawk, and you're not alone in this. Is there a kind of etiquette to ball hawking?
Well, definitely. There's a misconception that if I've caught 5,300 baseballs, then I must have knocked down 5,300 kids. But nothing could be further from the truth. I've been to more than 900 games in my life, and I've never knocked down anybody, young or old. I don't steal baseballs from people. I give baseballs to people. I help people catch balls. And, you know, there are jerks in all walks of life. So, yeah, there are some guys that do this that are definitely too aggressive. But I actually find that it's the people who've never caught a ball that you have to watch out for, because for them, they really do see it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and they really might do whatever it takes to get that ball. People who go to a lot of games and catch balls, we just kind of know what we're doing out there, and you know, we're very careful of other fans. You know, just smaller etiquette rules, you know, when to reach in front of someone and when not to. For example, if a ball is thrown to someone, well, it's pretty clearly intended for that person, so don't reach in front of them to get it. But if it's a home run, well, I don't think any fan can claim ownership of the ball while it's in midair. So, you know, if you want to jump or reach for a ball, even if it's heading towards someone else, you can do that. But then again, if that someone else is a kid, catch the ball and hand it to them. So, you know, there are ways to do this and still be very nice about it.
It's interesting you say that, because something happened about 20 years ago with my son when I was at a Phillies game, and a man, unnamed, literally took a ball out of his hands and gave it to his daughter. And I am still steamed about that. And it literally was about 20 years ago. Now, I don't know if he was a ball hawk or just a dad that wanted to give his daughter a baseball, but he did take it out of my son's hands. And I'm still and I'm still mad at him.
I don't blame you. Yeah, I've witnessed a lot of this stuff at games over the years. And, you know, I prefer to give baseballs to little kids with gloves who are trying hard on their own to get baseballs and maybe just coming up a bit short. But when I see a kid get robbed like that, you know, I'll definitely reach into my bag and pull out a ball and give one to that kid. So, I don't know.
Where were you 20 years ago, Zach Ample?
Well, 20 years ago, I had just barely caught my first ball 20 years ago and really didn't have any clue what I was doing. But wish I could have been there for you.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. And Zach Hampel is our guest today on Radio Times. He's known as a ball hawk, and over the years he has snagged or caught thousands of baseballs at games and batting practices. He's written several books, and the newest one is called simply The Baseball: Stunts, Scandals, and Secrets Beneath the Stitches. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA has art classes and workshops this fall in drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and more. Featuring Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, and master classes with classical realist artist and author Juliet Aristides and noted painters Bill Scott and Stuart Shills. PAFA CE, a community of artists of all ages and levels. Classes begin September 8th. For details, pafa.edu/CE.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing: storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM. Or listen online at whyy.org and newsworks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Employers routinely run background checks of job applicants on everything from their criminal records to credit reports, but now your virtual life could get a once-over, too. Companies could be scanning your Facebook and Twitter accounts looking for dirt.
Racist remarks, potentially violent behavior, illegal activities such as drug use, and sexually explicit material.
Social media background checks. We'll talk about it next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. And again, Zach Hampel is our guest today on Radio Times. He catches Major League Baseballs, not just an errant foul or a fly ball at a game. He has worked this art for a long time and has created a career for himself. His expertise in working the balls in something like 48 Major League stadiums produced his 1999 book called How to Snag Major League Baseballs. In 2007, he wrote Watching Baseball Smarter, and his new book is called The Baseball Stunts, Scandals, and Secrets Beneath the Stitches. And we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Zach, I know you've been asked this probably 1,000 times, but just
let's make it 1,001.
We'll do it 1,001 since we're all about numbers today. Tell us about your glove and the kind of glove that you use to snag baseballs.
Yes. I do have a little trick up my sleeve that has come to be known simply as the glove trick.
Yes.
It's much harder to describe than it is to show, but if anybody out there just simply does a search for glove trick on Google, my blog entry about it is the first thing that pops up. Basically, the way it works, if there's a ball sitting below me, ideally, let's say, if there's a gap between the outfield wall and the base of the stands, kind of like a little dead zone where a home run could clear the wall but fall short of the seats, in batting practice usually, I have a long piece of string tied to my glove. And I can actually lower that glove from the stands and pick up baseballs that are out of reach.
Wow.
Now, I rig the inside of the glove with a rubber band and a Sharpie, just a magic marker that kind of props the glove open. It's really hard to describe, so just do a search for it. But the point is that it's sort of like go-go gadget arms when I'm at the game sometimes.
And I appreciate that description. But this is obviously something you developed, evolved over time and over, I guess, hits and misses when it came to trying to grab these baseballs.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a native New Yorker, so when I was 13, 14, and going to a lot of games at Shea and the old Yankee Stadium, Yankee Stadium in particular, when I'd be hanging out in left and right field for batting practice, those outfield walls varied from, I think, 8 to 10 feet high. Mm. And there were so many baseballs that would just roll up onto the warning track and be sitting on the field 2 feet out from the wall, but, you know, 8 or 10 feet down below me. There were no players around. There were no security guards around. You know, this was the early 90s before the Yankees were a dynasty. There were very few people at those games. There'd be 12,000 people, you know, during the game on a weeknight, and there'd be a couple hundred maybe during batting practice. So after drooling over these baseballs for many months, I had to figure out a way to extend my reach and be able to get them. And after a little bit of trial and error, I came up with this trick and proudly called my parents into my bedroom and stood up on a chair, which I think had some wheels on the bottom, and they were freaked out that I was going to fall and break my head. But I showed them that I could pick up baseballs out of reach, and we all had a good laugh at it at the time. But it's actually
worked,
turned
right?
into a... What's that?
You said it has worked over the years.
Oh, right? I have gotten hundreds of baseballs with that trick over the years, and, you know, people tell me, oh, you should patent it. And, you know, I mean, I wrote about it in now 2 different books, and I've blogged about it, and I'm happy to help educate the competition. You know, I always want to catch every ball, but I realize that I can't. And part of the fun of, you know, being that guy who's caught so many balls is being able to spread the knowledge and to help other people catch balls and really to connect to the sport.
So how many languages can you say, hey, buddy, can you toss me that baseball?
More than 30 languages. I think 35 is the current count. You know, Spanish is a big one. There's so many Latino players in baseball. And if I can just back up for 1 second,
sure.
A great way to get a baseball is to get a player to throw one to you. Players love to throw balls into the crowd, especially before the game. And, you know, they prefer to toss balls to little kids and very attractive women. And since I am neither, I've had to be a little bit extra creative. And one strategy that I came up with years ago is to ask foreign players for baseballs in their native languages. So for the Latino players, I say, dame la pelota, por favor. And, of course, there's a lot of Japanese guys in baseball. So I've learned to say, choto, bo oro nagete kudasai. And, you know, it goes from there. I mean, if there's ever a Turkish player, I'll say, lütfen, bana bir topa tarmasın. And, you know, it just goes from there. A lot of these languages are just kind of like party tricks. You know, I don't think I'll ever have to use Swahili at a game, but
it's
just fun to sort of bust out a line every now and then and make people laugh.
Can you do it in Swahili?
Ni tupia mpira tafadhali.
Oh, that's great. But they must know you. The players must know you by now, yes?
There are some that do. You know, I think a lot of fans would love to have players know them. And I'll admit, it's a thrill for me when a player recognizes me. But I have found that over the years, when players recognize me, they usually then don't want to give me baseballs after that. It's sort of like, oh, it's you again. Well, how many baseballs do you need? Here you are asking for another one. I just saw you catch 12 yesterday. So I've kind of tried to keep a low profile. One of the very nicest players in all of baseball who I've gotten to know the best is Heath Bell, who's now the closer on the Padres. And when he first came up with the New York Mets in 2004, you know, he was being sent back and forth to the minor leagues. He was pitching in middle relief. The Mets weren't any good. He wasn't really established then. There was nobody at Shea Stadium, especially when you showed up 2.5 hours early, you know, on a cold, drizzly, you know, April evening. So I had just asked him for baseballs, I guess, one too many times, and eventually he recognized me and he was just like, man, what do you do with all these balls? But he was very friendly about it. Some guys have been snotty. He was genuinely interested in, you know, he said, you know, how many do you have and do you have a job? And I'm like, yeah, I have a job. I even got some money. Look, and I handed him my wallet and he started flipping through and I was, you know, I just said, hey, help yourself. Take what you need. He's like, I'm okay. Thanks. And it just kind of went from there and we had this friendly banter going and I've gotten to know him pretty well. We played catch from the stands, and he was on the field crouching down like a catcher, calling pitches and balls and strikes, and I was winding up like a pitcher in the actual seats. I've been raising money for a charity called Pitching for Baseball with my baseball collection. He actually made a rather generous donation to that charity a couple years ago. He saved a baseball for me from the 2009 All-Star Game and World Baseball Classic.
Wow.
Because they had commemorative logos on them, and he knew that I wouldn't be able to get them otherwise. And we were texting back and forth, figuring out, you know, which game I was going to go to that he'd be at on the East Coast, and he'd bring the balls and save them in his locker. So we've really gotten to know each other, and it's been pretty cool. So that's kind of like the best-case scenario. Worst case would be, you know, I would say another Mets pitcher from the mid-90s, Rick Reed, recognized me and for some reason just didn't like the fact that I caught so many balls. He would actually stand on the foul line during batting practice when I myself was hanging out down the line in foul territory hoping to scoop up ground balls. And he would run over and catch every ground ball heading towards me just so that I couldn't catch them. And it's like, man, you're in the major leagues. You don't even pay for these baseballs. Why are you preventing me from catching a few? So, I don't know. You get the best and you get the worst of people when you do this.
But it sounds like you are, if you root for anything in baseball, it's for maybe a particular player but not a team?
Yeah, you know, I grew up as a Mets fan. And I should have been miserable in 1993 when the team lost, I think it was 103 games that year. But I realized that the more the Mets lost, the emptier Shea Stadium was. And so it was sort of like I took the good with the bad. It's like, well, my team really stunk. But then again, there was really not much competition when I was running around and trying to catch baseballs. And so it didn't break my heart quite as much when the Mets lost. And I should have, for example, hated Greg Maddux because he pitched for the rival Braves. But I just loved I loved that guy. I loved the way he played. I loved that he was just this sort of schlumpy, average-looking white guy who was my size, and yet he just dominated major league hitters. I rooted for him no matter where he was pitching, and when he came to play the Mets, I found myself rooting for him still. And over the years, I've just realized that I tend to root more for individual players than teams. And at this point, I really don't have a favorite team at all. I mean, if anything, it might be the Padres, just because Heath Bell plays for them, and he's been so nice to me. But I'm a huge fan of the sport, and that's really how I look at it.
And do you have hats for all the major league teams that you wear, depending on where you are?
Yeah, exactly. And because I don't have a favorite team, I feel a little less guilty about that. I do own a hat and a shirt of all 30 major league teams. And another great trick to get a player to toss you a ball is to dress up like you're a fan of the visiting team, because they love to spot their quote-unquote fans on the road. You know, it's like, if I'm going to Citi Field tonight, I'll be wearing my Padres gear when the Padres are out on the field for batting practice. And those guys will think, wow, look at this diehard Padres fan. He just traveled across the country to see us play. Or, you know, maybe I'm a Padres fan who just happens to live here. But anyway, I'll be much more likely to get baseballs tossed up to me as a result. And that this is a trick that really rubs some people the wrong way, and for that, I apologize. I mean no disrespect to any team. Like I said, I'm just a fan of the sport. I love catching baseballs. The more balls I catch, the more money I raise for charity, the more baseballs I can give away, and it's just, it's my way of connecting to the game. You know, a lot of people play fantasy baseball. This is my version of fantasy baseball. It's just my way of making it a little bit interactive and feeling like I can be somewhat of a participant.
And that's Zach Hampel, our guest today on Radio Times, and he is a ball hawk. He has snagged thousands of balls at games all across the country, at Major League Baseball games. He's written several books. The newest one is called The Baseball, Stunts, Scandals, and Secrets Beneath the Stitches, and I do want to talk about The Baseball after we take a couple of calls here, and I should say that the book does include some tips for snagging Major League Baseballs, And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me see what Sam from Devon has to say. And Sam, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question with regard to autograph baseballs. When I was a boy in the late, probably it was the late 50s or even the early 60s, my father was at a Phillies game, caught a ball, and then he managed to get the team to autograph it. I think he may have known the coach, who I believe his name was Solly Amos. I don't know if that rings a bell with anybody who's a baseball fan. I'm not particularly a baseball fan. But anyway, I have this ball, and I was wondering, from what I'm hearing, you mostly snag the balls, and in the beginning you never even bothered to catalog them. It seems like you just get the ball. Is there another aspect to it where you get the balls and then manage to get X amount of autographs or certain autographs or maybe even the entire team?
Sam, thanks for the call. Zach Hampel, go ahead.
I've gotten probably 1,500 autographs over the years, but very, very few on baseballs. I usually get ticket stubs signed just because when I first started collecting baseballs, I didn't want to do anything to them that would change their original condition. However I caught them, that's how I wanted to keep them. That meant not playing with them, not getting them autographed, not labeling them in any way. So I got my 1,000, 2,000, 3,000th balls, no, sorry, number 1, 2, and 4,000th balls signed by the players who tossed them to me. Number 3,000, I reeled in with the glove trick, so I guess I probably could have signed that one myself, but I left that one alone. And I'm still trying to get number 5,000 signed. That was a home run hit in batting practice by Alex Rios, an outfielder on the White Sox. I caught that this year in Toronto. I heard he's almost impossible to get an autograph from, but you know, I'll be in Baltimore this week for the White Sox, so maybe miracles will happen. But those are the only balls that I've ever tried to get signed. Charlie Sheen, unfortunately, signed one of my baseballs that I lent to CBS for a segment. It came back to me autographed, and I was actually pretty disappointed at the time. But I think it's funny now. So that's, I don't know, I don't really go for autographs that much because, I don't know, to me it just seems like it takes more skill to get a baseball than an autograph. There are far fewer baseballs available than autographs that can be signed. You know, one player can stand there for an hour and sign for hundreds of people. And I just find that collecting autographs is more of a product of just sort of being somewhere and putting in the time than catching baseballs, where, generally speaking, you need to have a certain level of athleticism and coordination. And, you know, I think there's a lot more planning involved. And, you know, I understand that getting autographs is a huge skill in and of itself, and no disrespect meant, but for me personally, I think it's more of a challenge to get baseball, so that's what I've focused on.
Sam, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Zach, on the front of your book is a rather beat-up-looking baseball, and you literally do take a baseball apart to see what's inside. And it was, I have to say, more interesting than I thought it was going to be. It really is a ball within a ball, yes?
It is. There is almost 1,000 feet of yarn and thread inside every ball. There's four different layers. You have a very thin white polycotton thread. You have 3-ply and 4-ply gray and tan yarn. All that stuff is wound by machines around the core of the ball, which is made with compressed rubber and granulated cork, which comes from Indonesia and Portugal. You have sort of a vulcanized rubber layer around that. It's a very complicated process. I mean, the cowhide itself, there's a huge process for you know, preparing the cowhide and stripping it of the bacteria and bleaching it and kind of slicing it almost like you would a bagel to the right thickness. The cowhide has to measure within, I think the parameters are like a hundredth of an inch. So it's even just stitching the baseball, a lot of people think that baseballs are made entirely by machines, but they are in fact still hand-stitched to this day. And I was fortunate enough to get to visit the Rawlings Baseball Factory last year in Turrialba, Costa Rica. There are 350 employees there whose sole jobs are to stitch baseballs by hand all day long. And it takes the average employee about 14 minutes to stitch up a ball.
In fact, you describe this inspection room where, like all factories, there are inspection rooms. But if there's even the most minute flaw, it's sent back to the person who stitched the ball.
Yeah, there's this, there's a lot of speculation about, oh, the balls are juiced and they're not uniform and this and that. Man, if you ever go see the factory, and it's really hard to get in there, but I mean, seeing it firsthand, it is impossible to imagine how the balls could be juiced, because every ball has to weigh a certain amount and measure a certain size. So think about it this way. If you were if they calibrated those machines to wrap the yarn around the ball even tighter, because that's going to make it livelier, well, think about it. You're going to have much more yarn in the same amount of space, and then the ball is going to weigh too much. So it's really, I mean, the whole idea of juicing the ball, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you see how meticulous they are as far as weighing and measuring the baseball at every stage of the process, and they do compression tests, and oh my God, it's unbelievable. But one of the coolest things that I saw, that I learned, you know, in the course of researching the book and being there, if you ever go to a game and catch a baseball, even in batting practice, try to look at that baseball in black light. You may more often than not find that baseball will have an invisible ink stamp on it, just a little like serial code of a few numbers. And basically, this is something that happens at the factory, and it's part of the quality control process. After every stitcher completes a ball, there's a floor manager who comes and collects these baseballs, gives it a very quick inspection, very quick, to make sure that nothing major is wrong with it. And every employee has a stamp at their workstation with a personalized code on it, 350 different stamps. And that inspector will then take that employee's stamp, dip it in invisible ink, and stamp the ball. Then all the balls from all these employees get thrown into a barrel, which is then wheeled into another inspection room where they look much more closely at the baseballs. At that point, if they find something wrong with the balls, for example, if one of the stitches is not quite tight enough, or if the two figure-eight shaped pieces of cowhide are not aligning properly, something that can be fixed, they'll pull that ball aside, look at it under black light, make a note of the serial code, and send it back to that employee who stitched it.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Zach Hampel. We are talking about baseballs, and his new book is called The Baseball. He is a ball hawk, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Rowan University supports WHYY. In today's economy, Rowan University understands the need to continue your education on your terms. They offer graduate studies online with accelerated coursework or in a classroom setting in areas such as business, education, engineering and technology, communication, music, and more. The College of Graduate and Continuing Education is hosting an information session Saturday, August 13th. More information at rowanu.com/WHYY or 856-256-4747.
Think of Italy without the tomato. Unimaginable. But the tomato originated in South America. When Columbus crossed the Atlantic, the exchange of not only food, but animals, insects, and viruses among the continents transformed the world. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Charles C. Mann, author of 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
In the past, retirement seemed so cut and dry. You'd reach a certain age and plunge into those golden years of free time and recreation. Now, in light of the economy and new quality of life choices we make, this stage of life can mark something quite different for each of us. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, retirement. It's being redefined, just as we are. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with ball hawk Zach Sample. His mission throughout the baseball season is to snag as many baseballs as he can with his glove, whether at practice or during a game. He's written three books, the latest one called The Baseball, about some of the tricks he's developed as a ball hawk, the history of the baseball itself, and some of the wackier baseball stunts that have been tried over the years. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Zach, I was aware of Lena Blackburn's rubbing mud, but I wasn't aware of all the history that created this thing that is done to baseballs today.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Every baseball that's used in the major leagues, and even the minor leagues, and even colleges, and you know, you can go younger than that, the balls are rubbed with a very special and specific kind of mud before they're actually used in games. And the reason why is, if you were to take a brand new baseball out of the box, it is so shiny and white that it would create a glare for the hitters and make it hard for them to see. The cowhide is also very slick, and it would be hard for the pitchers to get a good grip on it. So going back many decades, baseball people realized that they had to do something to the surface of the ball to make it a little bit better for both the pitchers and batters, and there's a very specific kind of mud that is used. It's called Lena Blackburn rubbing mud, and it's collected from a tributary off the Delaware River in southern New Jersey, and every major league team receives 64 ounces of this stuff at the start of the season, and that little amount is enough to rub up thousands upon thousands of baseballs. In the book, I was kind of breaking down the numbers, how much mud is used versus how many balls they go through, and what I came up with is, if you were to take a United States penny and cut it into 10 pieces, and you were to take one of those pieces, that's about how much mud gets rubbed on each ball. So it's a very small amount. It doesn't make the ball gloppy and dirty. It just makes it slightly darker and slightly less slick. And, you know, bringing this back to Philly for a moment, I was invited by the equipment manager of the Phillies, a gentleman named Dan O'Rourke, to come hang out for a day at Citizens Bank Park when the Phillies were on the road. And he's the guy who's personally responsible for rubbing up the baseballs with mud. Wow. And he showed me how he does it, and he let me try it. And I actually got to rub up some balls that he said were going to be used in games. So that was probably the most fun bit of research that I got to do for the book.
Well, let me get back to our callers. It looks like we have Christina from Center City, Philadelphia. And Christina, no, we don't seem to have Christina.
Oh, Christina. Oh.
Well, you know what? She had a question that I had, which is, I mean, you have collected all these baseballs over the years. Are there ones, though, that just... there's a kind of a magic moment associated with getting that baseball?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. On a personal level, you know, all the milestones, 1,000, 2,000, et cetera, those are great. But I think what really stands out are the historic home runs, the ones that are important for the baseball world itself. I think probably the best one I got was the last home run that the New York Mets ever hit at Shea Stadium.
Oh, wow.
And I know Philly fans are cringing.
We are, but that's okay.
I mean, you know. I also caught Barry Bonds' 724th career home run. And this year I've caught two home runs that were the first Major League home runs for those players. I caught one hit by Mike Nickias, who was a backup catcher. Well, he was sent down to the minors, and now he's back, a backup catcher on the Mets. And I also caught the first home run of Mike Trout, who's actually the number one prospect in all of baseball. I think probably a lot of fans have heard of this kid named Bryce Harper. Well, Mike Trout is rated even higher than Harper. So it was pretty cool to catch that ball, and I was specifically trying to catch it. And that was just a couple of weeks ago in Baltimore. So, you know, there have definitely been some important ones. And I gave both of those balls back to the players who hit them, and I really didn't ask for anything in return. I could have held out for all kinds of memorabilia and stuff, but I just wanted them to have their baseballs back. My one request was just that I get to give the baseballs back to them myself so I get to shake their hand. And
that's nice.
That was about it.
And just the thrill, literally, of catching the ball, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, this is one way that I suppose I could say I get an adrenaline rush. Right. You know, I've been skydiving. That kind of bored me a little bit.
Really?
Yeah, no joke. I was kind of disappointed.
Wasn't dangerous or scary enough for you?
I don't know. I mean, I just figured if I'm going to die, I'm going to die, so I'm not going to worry about it. But the actual free falling itself, I don't know. You're so high up that the scenery down below doesn't even change. So visually, you can't even tell that you're falling. There's so much air resistance blowing against you that you can hardly even open your eyes. And, you know, I was strapped into an instructor on my back, so I had the air resistance on one side, the guy strapped in on the back.
Oh, hum.
It wasn't a free falling. So I was like, oh, man, this is it? But, man, catching a home run at a game, for me, I don't know, nothing beats that as far as getting my heart racing and really just getting pumped up about one particular moment.
Well, I hear you. Let me get back to our callers. We have, it looks like, Tom from Collingswood, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. And we seem to be having some problems.
Man, I am offended.
We're trying to figure out some technical issues here. But he also had a question I had for you. People, including presidents, often get asked to throw out first pitches. And President Obama didn't do a very good job. It's hard to throw a baseball, is it not?
Yeah, I think it's hard to, you know, be a genius and be athletic at the same time. And I don't know. I just think that, you know, presidents are usually, you know, they're very educated people, generally speaking, and they sort of devote their lives to politics and, you know, intellectual matters and probably don't focus so much on athletic pursuits. I mean, Obama's pretty good at basketball,
yeah.
I guess. But, yeah, throwing a baseball can definitely be a difficult thing, and you know, you add that to the pressure of having everybody watching you and being out on the mound. Usually when people play catch, they're not standing on a mound, so when you're actually stepping and going downhill, it's very difficult. And I actually have a chance possibly next year to throw out a ceremonial first pitch at a minor league game, and I'm really excited and a little bit nervous. I just don't want to bounce it. You know, there's some awful YouTube highlights of people throwing these balls every which way, and I definitely don't want that to be me.
And will you stand on the actual pitcher's mound, or will you move in a little bit?
I'll stand on second base and do it. No, I want to make the proper full distance pitch. So if they let me, sometimes the grounds crew might take, you know, issue with the fact that you're stepping on their precious mound and, you know, leaving shoe prints. But if they'll let me, then I'm definitely going to do it that way. I might even throw a knuckleball.
Well, I say good luck to you. But is there a time in a baseball stadium that you like the best, as someone who loves baseballs?
A time during the day, you mean?
Yeah, or time at the stadium. I don't know whether before a game, after a game, you know, in the middle. I don't know. I was just curious.
Well, the most fun part for me is actually batting practice. You know, you show up hours before game time with any ticket. You can get in the stadium as soon as it opens. You know, they can't open a stadium 5 minutes before the first pitch. They have to let people find their seats. And, of course, they hope that you'll buy a lot of overpriced food at the concession stands.
Right.
So, you know, you basically find out when your local stadium opens. Citizens Bank Park opens 2.5 hours early, but then they kind of keep you confined to left field. So, yeah, for me, that's the most fun time of the day because there's just so many baseballs in use and baseballs flying into the crowd. There's less security, less fans. The players are looser. So that's a lot of fun for me.
Well, you also say there are these quote-unquote Easter eggs. These are balls that have been, I guess, left in stadiums from previous games.
Yeah, or even from early batting practice that very day. Yeah, when balls fly into the seats before the fans are there, sometimes the ushers comb through and collect them, and I guess they're supposed to throw them back on the field, and probably some do and some don't. And in a lot of cases, the ushers just don't get there that early, and it varies from stadium to stadium, and sometimes you can find many, many baseballs in the stands. I think my personal record is I found 7 in one day.
Wow.
I know a guy who claims to have found 11 balls out in the left field seats in Baltimore one time when he ran in, so these things do happen. In New York, you almost never find an Easter egg. Philadelphia, it's pretty rare. But it just depends on that stadium and what their policies are and how early they have their ushers get there.
Your book also has some really interesting stories of moments in baseball. This goes back to the 1930s, and a Cubs catcher named Gabby Harnett caught a baseball that was dropped 800 feet out of an airplane.
I think it was a blimp.
Or a blimp, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a whole chapter in the book called Stunts, basically. And it's just, it covers some of the wacky things that, that people have done with baseballs over the years. And that was one of them. You know, there was this sort of challenge to see who could catch a baseball dropped from the greatest height. Babe Ruth actually caught one dropped from an airplane, or, you know, supposedly caught one. It was about 250 feet high and traveling 100 miles an hour. The more I think about it, the more difficult I think it would have been to pull off. But, you know, it's written as an official news story. I got it right from the archives of the Hall of Fame. So if they say that it's fact, then I'll take them at their word. But guys have caught balls dropped off the top of the Washington Monument. There was one guy, Joe Sprins, at the World's Fair in 1939, who tried to catch one dropped from a blimp. He got his glove on it, but the force of the ball smashed his glove into his face and broke his jaw and knocked out a few teeth. And he's actually the last guy who ever attempted to do that. Now, I would love to attempt to break that record. I'll just wear a catcher's mask, you know? And I'd love to break that record from more than 1,000 feet high. You know, rent a helicopter, get FAA approval, go to an airfield somewhere, and that would be fun to try to break that. So if anyone out there wants to hook it up, let's do it.
I was going to say, someone can certainly take you up on that. Also, a story about a baseball game at an Army base. This was during World War II, and the ball was hit just as a plane was making a landing. What happened?
Yeah, you know, it was just a small little baseball field, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, but they had a landing strip right next to it, and there was a foul ball hit. You know, it wasn't even a stadium, really. It was just a little field, so it was hit sort of, you know, out of the field. And as a plane was coming in for a landing, the ball smashed through the windshield, hit the pilot in the face, knocked him unconscious, and it was like a little two-seater plane. There was a passenger in the back seat with no flying experience, and he reached up, grabbed the controls, and pulled him back to prevent the plane from crashing, and, you know, kept that thing airborne for a little while, and eventually the pilot regained consciousness and was able to land the plane miles away. And it's just one of the many crazy stories about baseballs.
Well, and it's surprising that at all these Major League Baseball games that more people aren't hurt. You actually have, I'm looking at a picture of Herb Score with this, you know, huge bandage over his face. He got hit in the face with a line drive. But it is surprising that more people aren't hurt, it seems to me.
Yeah, amazingly, only one fan in the history of Major League Baseball has ever been killed by getting hit by a foul ball. It was a 14-year-old kid named Alan Fish who got nailed, unfortunately, by a Manny Mota foul ball at Dodger Stadium in 1970. And he was actually okay at the moment. He kind of had a little bit of a headache, and they took him to the first aid room and looked him over, and they gave him some pills to make the pain go away, and he went back to his seat and even chased a foul ball later in the game. What they didn't realize was that his brain was hemorrhaging at the time, and when he went home that night, I mean, it all fell apart for him, and his family rushed him to the hospital. It's just a tragic story, and there's a whole chapter in the book called Death by Baseball. Of course, you know, we all know the story that happened recently of that fan in Arlington, Texas, who died reaching for a ball that was tossed up, I think, in between innings, and he just lost his balance, flipped over a railing, and plunged about 15 feet, you know, head first. And what I realize is that the desire to catch a baseball is often more destructive than the force of the baseball itself.
Have you ever hurt yourself?
I have. The worst was probably cracking a rib. I'm not proud of this. At this point, I can only laugh it off. 2008, I was at a game in Anaheim, and it was just stupid. It was a batting practice home run that hit a seat and deflected high up in the air over my head. And I was kind of turned sideways in the seat, so I leaned to my left, to my glove side, sort of facing down the slope, and just reached too far, tipped over, plunged into the next row, and a metal armrest just got me right in the side. I broke my nose once when a fan right in front of me jumped up for a batting practice homer, and it deflected off his hands, changed course just slightly, and bonked me right in the nose. Sprained my ankle pretty badly this year, and I was on crutches for a few weeks. So these things happen. You know, I've never had a near-death experience at a game. I was at a Mets game recently, and I leaned over the front row down the left field foul line a little bit too far and nearly fell onto the field. And I heard from friends who were watching the game that Keith Hernandez, the Mets announcer, said something like, oh, that fan's lucky he wasn't in the upper deck. Well, come on, Keith. I wouldn't have been reaching for a ball like that if I were in the upper deck.
And if you knew who you were, I guess, too, right?
Yeah, well, I'm glad they didn't know who I was because it was a little bit embarrassing. I did end up getting the ball, though. So, bumps and bruises do happen. When I was younger, I said the ball lasts forever and the pain goes away. Now I try to be a little bit more careful because I think the older you get, the longer it takes to heal up. But people, you just got to be careful out there. You know, you got to want it. You got to really go for it. But at the same time, you got to know your limits.
Well, Zach Campbell, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
It was great to have you on. And he joined us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And his book is called The Baseball. And he is a ball hawk. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. We want to close things out with Mabel Scott hitting it out of the ballpark with Baseball Boogie.
If I pitch, can you catch? Will you hold the ball? When you step to the plate, will you swing and fall? If you play, you gotta know how it's done. Can you catch? Can you hold a hard one? I mean, baby, do you know the game? Do you know the game?